Good afternoon. My name is Lowry Sabalkin. I'm with the Friends of the Boundary Mountains. Pleased to meet you all. Dr. Publicover, will Maine warm up in the decades to come?
I think that's pretty well established by climate science, yes.
Thank you. Your testimony notes that Maine's highest regions, including these boundary mountains, have value specifically as, I hope I got this right, climatically stable places, correct?
The evidence is, from both paleoclimatic and current research is that the higher elevation subalpine forests of the Northeast Mountains were particularly stable during past warmer periods and are likely to remain stable to some extent during future warming periods.
I'll take that as very close to a yes.
I mean, at some point it might get so warm. That may not be true.
There have been so many good questions already, I'm going to skip quite a few to save repetition. But I'm going to repeat this one. Is it likely that in a stunted forest, and in your description, what we are dealing with in this hearing is a stunted forest, edge effect will be more profound than an identical type of construction down in the lowland?
I think edge effect would be more significant up here, not because it's a stunted forest. All things being equal, I think a stunted forest would probably be less impacted by edge effect. But up at this area, in particular, the high wind regime and the exposure caused by a wide road on a slope would make this more significant than something at lower elevation. So I think it's the high wind regime, not so much the stunted forest, that makes it particularly significant.
All right, well then, I'm going to take that as a yes, because whether we label it stunted forest or just a short forest in a high place with a lot of wind, I'm going to take your answer as yes, edge effect will be pretty profound. Do you agree that when we include edge effect in our plotting of the disruption of the natural environment up on the ridge, we are creating a disturbed zone that can be as much as 4,000 feet long, one end of this project up through to the other? Maybe it's only 3,000, but it's a mile or more.
I think it's a mile, yeah. I think
okay.
More than 4,000.
By several hundred feet wide.
For some effects, potentially, yeah.
Okay.
On the upwind side, it's probably less on the downwind side.
Can the construction of specifically the access road coming up from Kibby Stream that intersects this project about in the middle and this mile or more by potentially a few hundred feet wide area of disturbance plus edge effect result in something that we could call a fracturing or of a forest community?
That's not a term I would use. I know that's a term that Chris Mazur used in an old book about fragmentation, but I'm not sure I would use that term.
Okay.
Because I'm not sure what you mean by it.
Well, earlier in your, I was going to skip this, but you said your testimony states that larger examples of a forest type have greater resilience and are more likely to persist while than smaller parcels or parcels that have been significantly fragmented.
Yes.
So I'm accusing this project of fragmenting this chunk of fir birch forest by running a road up through one side of it and then cracking it across the top with a turbine string. Thank you. Does this particular fir heartleaf birch community have a connection at high elevation to the high ground of the north as compared to the Kibby Range where you go down into a deep valley and there's no high ground connection specifically to the north? That's important to me.
I haven't looked in detail at the topography, but I think it's fairly continuously above 2,700 feet up towards the Caribou Mountain area, I believe you're talking about.
Thank you. Now, in the land use planning document, policy number 13, I'm going to take part of one sentence, and I admit that a lot of people don't like it when you take things out of context, but this says, if I understand correctly, one of the purposes is to regulate high mountain areas to preserve the natural equilibrium of vegetation and geology, and then a good deal more. Am I correct in this interpretation? Equilibrium of any community or a chemical equilibrium, any kind of equilibrium, can only be maintained if the system remains in a somewhat fluid state. We're talking about the adjustability of a system to cope with change around it. Is this accurate? Don't know is a very good answer.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think I understand the ability of something to respond to disturbance is a manner in which things adjust and maintain stability. And if you take away the ability to sort of respond, you take away the resilience, yes.
Okay. If we cut off or sever this connection, let's pretend this table is the ridge of Sisk Mountain and the folks down at the Trans-Canada table are the summit, the southern summit of Sisk, and that's Canada. And you have any species, specifically non-flying, any species of creature, or to a much, much lesser degree, plant species, if we cut off a connection with a mile long by several hundred feet right at the steepest, narrowest part of this ridge, are we not threatening to restrict the adjustability, the possibility of maintaining an environmental equilibrium? It's a chokehold. Could that be correct?
I think there are probably some species whose ability to migrate from this community to, you know, forests to the north would be compromised. They'd probably be somewhat smaller species. They're not going to be bird species. You know, some types of ground-dwelling insects, mm-hmm. some types of potentially small mammals, some types of plant species that don't migrate.
So you're going to give me
air.
Some.
I'm going to give you a qualified yes.
Thank you. In your testimony, you discussed what you called refuges, and I'm going to paraphrase you terribly. The world warms up. The lowlands are affected, the fir forests begin to die back and evolve, change into whatever comes next, etc. If we, to be very specific to this mountain string from Sisk up north through the high ground, if we put a choke point on that, are we potentially destroying one of these refuges that you're talking about, where to a small degree, plant communities, but more importantly, animal communities, trying to get up into a climate that they're bred, evolved to survive in, all of a sudden they're stuck because we were up there yesterday. We have these roads. We have hard, hard surfaces. We have wide open spaces where predators can get you. And we have noise and commotion and human intervention. And I'm not saying this week, this month, or next year. I'm talking 25 years or potentially 50 years down the road as the world changes and warms up. Might we be destroying or really limiting one of these refuges?
I think, you know, the impacts of this project will potentially affect the ability of this area to serve as a refuge, but not for necessarily the reasons you're stating. I don't think it's so much because species won't be able to move into and out of it, but the fact that so much of it is exposed to edge, you're imposing an enhanced and a somewhat artificial disturbance regime on it, which will lead to a different community structure than would naturally occur, may lead to less of that area developing into a mature, you know, a sort of more mature subalpine forest. You're going to maintain more of it in a younger condition. More of it may dry out, and that may impact its ability to maintain itself in the future.
Once again, it's a qualified yes.
It's a yes coming at it from a right angle.
Is there a point at which local cumulative impact becomes an extremely important factor? I'm thinking QBA series, which is essentially done, and from yesterday's examination quite professionally. B series is going to be done here at the end of the year. Now this, and then who knows what's next relative to this area. Are we there yet?
Are we there yet for what?
Is there a point at which local cumulative impact becomes an extremely important factor?
It
would
does,
cause
that,
you to say no more.
Well, that tipping point is going to come at a different place for different species, for Bicknell's thrush.
No, your support for the project. Have we got there yet? Maybe at Tower 8, or maybe I could convince you to say we're already there.
I would say
wind on this ridge.
I would say turbine 8 is, you know, the 8 northern turbines is about as much wind as we'd want to see in the northern boundary mountains. I would say that's,
okay.
I think we would be maybe unlikely to support.
Thank you.
Additional.
I'm going to pick on Ms. Johnson next. First, I need to know this. When you and I both wear glasses, are you nearsighted or farsighted?
You know, I'm getting old, and whatever it is when you get old, that's what it is. I have only worn glasses for a few years, so what does that mean?
Take them off. Can you see a mile away, or do you need them to see a mile away?
I can see a mile away.
All right, thank you. Very good. Save my bacon. From how far away can you see the light on a cell tower?
I don't know.
Miles at night?
I would presume so.
Okay. I can tell you folks, I'm a ski patrolman here, up on the top, the snowmakers can see the lights on the Kibbe project well enough that they can count them, individual lights on the towers. When you personally are in a truly remote place and you look down at a highway, you're hiking up on who knows what, and you look down on a highway, can you see one tractor trailer moving down a highway?
Depends on how far away you are.
Okay. Call it 3 miles.
You know, I don't really think in those terms when I'm on top of a mountain, so I'm not sure I'm that good at estimating distance.
Okay.
So I would think probably, but not sure.
Then I'll get away from numbers. If you're standing in a high, quiet place and you look down in the valley, does it take very much motion to capture your attention? Trucks, cars, equipment. Does it take very much motion?
No, it doesn't. If okay. It's something that's not normally found there.
In your testimony on page 5, you commented that Maine residents and visitors visit this remote feeling place, referring to Chain of Ponds, remote feeling but accessible area, specifically to enjoy the scenic views and to participate in recreational cultural activities, the high quality of which is dependent on that specific highly scenic setting. How much stimulation, visual stimulation, can you take in a pond, on one of these lakes, in a canoe on one of these ponds, before you're no longer in that highly scenic setting, and instead you are actually now stuck on a turbine, or two turbines, or some turbines? How much does it take before your attention is grabbed?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how you would measure it. I think our conclusion in this case is that the 7 southern turbines are close enough and, as Jim Palmer said, prominent, that they would, in fact, I think he said collectively dominant, that they would dominate your view if you're on Chain of Ponds.
Okay. Do I have permission to make a statement instead of a fake question? I submit that when I'm there and I look at the mountain,
no.
Okay, thank you. We're going to... You were clear in your testimony that just because there is development, wind energy development in an area, does not mean that a green light has been given to keep developing the next ridge and the next ridge. Let's jump over to the Kibbe Stream side. Is it okay to surround a Class A waterway, which is Kibbe Stream, with industrial development on 3 sides of that watershed? This will be the 3rd side. Is that acceptable?
Kibby Stream is one of the resources of state significance that would be impacted by turbines on Sisk.
Mm-hmm. So we've got it on the south, more or less, and the east, more or less, or we will have in 1 year. Is it going to be acceptable to put them on the west side now? Because all of them turbines are above that watershed. I'd really like a, no, it's not acceptable.
Well, our conclusion is that while there will be impacts from the 8 northern turbines on Kibby Stream, Arnold Pond, Crosby Pond, and some portion of Chain of Ponds, that those adverse impacts of the 8 northern turbines do not rise to the level of being undue adverse impacts requiring a denial of the permit.
You're not going to get a star. You, in your testimony, advise us that if the southern 7 turbines are built, efforts to get funding for future conservation efforts, easements and so on, in the Chain of Ponds region will be more challenging. Unless this application is denied in its entirety, will not funders view this area as essentially open to development?
Well, it's hard to know how funders will view it, but it is my opinion that a project will not score as highly. A potential conservation project in, let's say, the Chain of Ponds region would not score as highly in most of the scoring systems for public money if the 7 southern turbines, which are so in your face, mm-hmm. From Chain of Ponds, are constructed.
Just a few minutes ago, you very stoically withstood a serious grilling by TransCanada's attorney. Is this correct? The industry got a little bit of support from the environmental organizations, and now because they got a little bit of support, they're upset because you're saying no more. You gave them support for Black Knoll. Now you're at least 50% saying, no, we don't want that here. And she's saying, well, we got it last time. I want it back. Please explain why you're not going to get drug over the coals again.
Madam Chair, it seems to me this is the quintessential example of friendly cross. And I think this is intended to be cross, not friendly cross.
I would humbly suggest this is not friendly.
Well, my job here is not to make them look good.
If this is friendly,
I don't want them to say no to all of these things.
This is not friendly because we feel strongly about the
We understood that we were questioning the consolidated interveners who have announced that they are against the project, but they're also in favor of 8 turbines. And it's not friendly to us at all, and we don't feel friendly to them. So I reject that objection.
Based on the questioning so far, it does appear that you have been directing your questions towards distinguishing between the two sections of the project, but I guess I would just suggest that in your questioning, you try to make it clear which section of the turbines you're questioning about, so that it's clear that your questions are focused on the issues at which you differ.
All right.
And I just want to let you know you have about 5 minutes.
You recommend a mitigation payment be made perhaps to the Public Lands Bureau as a palliative measure, correct?
Yes.
How much, and you gave us a number. I realize it wasn't a rock-solid number, but you picked one, so I'll use it, $100,000. How much lynx habitat is $100,000 going to buy?
I have no idea.
Neither do I, but it's not much. you and your group are trying to preserve the experience of being in a wilderness and of remoteness. Am I not correct that even one or two or three of the northern turbines, if I'm on the lake and I'm from the city and I'm expecting silence and maybe a moose, that's going to grab me. Am I right?
I think this is an area where it's important to be precise in our language. In my testimony, I did not say this was a wilderness or it was remote. I did say it was a remote feeling but accessible place. To me, there's a big difference in those two things, and I want to make sure that that distinction is clear. I do think that people who are from the city, who are coming down and camping on the shores of Long Pond and paddling or fishing out on the pond, will have a remote feeling experience that will be significantly adversely impacted by the Southern Seven Turbines.
I should have known that if she couldn't beat you up, I certainly couldn't. I'd like to ask you one or two questions. And instead of being in this big bird survey, it mentioned that the Biodiversity Research Institute counted, if I got it right, 21 birds in this location.
That's what I read, too.
Plus or minus half of them are males. Can you or we afford to place a wind turbine complex this close to a proven nesting ground when just one young male bird can reduce his population by 10% because he's doing his mating flight? Can we afford that loss?
I would say no.
Do you give enough credence to the map? You know the map I'm talking about. It would be right.
I think so.
That one.
Oh, the model, yeah.
That shows the nesting ground of this bird. On the other hand, the big chart that shows the core zone and the possible zone.
Yeah.
Do they agree with one another?
You're asking if that figure three, the model, agrees with the.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think they're two different. That's a computer model based on simulation, satellites, and GIS. The other piece that I presented earlier is on the ground, somebody walking in the woods and counting.
Given that disagreement, does the applicant know for sure where this bird species nests versus for sure where it doesn't nest? I got two questions left.
I think that's what I tried to say in my testimony, is that the data has to be interpreted with caution. So, yes, I would agree with you that.
In your data, it talks about these birds move around considerably, and they don't necessarily show up in the same counting location.
Right.
Much more reliably than once in 5 years. Would you be more comfortable, before we permit something like this, if we said we need 5 years of counting? Because we're supposed to be protecting this special creature. Would you like, professionally, 5 years to figure out where it is or isn't specific to the northern string of turbines? How do we know they're not there?
I think there's a balance between promoting wind power and getting as much information as you can. I would leave it up to IF&W or other agencies to determine the number of years.
Okay.
You're right that 1 year is the minimum that you would have to do.
I would submit that we don't have the data. Would your organizations, all three of them, be willing to ask, maybe not for 5 years, but ask for some more time? I recognize that there are financial considerations and stimulus monies and this and that, but respectfully, I don't care. From our side of the argument, would your groups find it to be reasonable to say we want 2 years of bird studies, 2 years of watching the climate change, 2 years of monitoring tourists down in Chain of Ponds and uses, and so on?
I think the more information you collect, the more time you spend collecting it, the more effort that goes into it. We don't know the effort that went into the 2009 data. We don't know how many people. We don't know how many hours. We know the days because they reported the days. It is true that the more effort that goes in and the into a collecting data about a project, the more sort of the more useful the data is in terms of your results and how you interpret that in relation to a project.
Where I'm going with all these questions is if we guess wrong, we've tore the top off this mountain and stove up an awful lot of terrain. I would like some time to make sure that it's not a wrong guess, but an evaluated, data-supported decision. Thanks.
Okay. I would like to take a 10-minute break and then come back and do the redirect. Okay.